The truth is out there.
From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on October 17th when scientists took note of an asteroid, but this one was different. This one was from another solar system, and it's a shape that scientists have never seen before. About 400 meters long, estimated to be 40 meters wide, long and thin, and it's on its way back out of our solar system, moving at a high rate of speed, too fast for us to catch up with it. Let's not jump to conclusions here, but here's Newsweek's headline on the object. Mysterious asteroid Oumuamua could be a galactic bus carrying life between solar systems. So, we're not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens. Okay, probably not, but it's still very interesting, and it points to different theories for how life evolved on Earth. There are ties to astrobiology here, and it's a good reason to bring back one of the best science communicators anywhere in the solar system or beyond, a man who might want to be riding Oumuamua itself right now. That's Adam Frank. Adam, welcome back to the program. How are you, sir?
Doing well. Pleasure to be back.
Well, it's always good to have you. I think I'm pronouncing Oumuamua correctly, but am I pronouncing panspermia correctly? What's that?
Panspermia. Yeah, that's kind of a weird word. It's sort of like you have to sort of snicker every time you say it. panspermia is the idea that life did not begin on Earth, that life was transported here from somewhere else. And it sounds like a kind of a crazy idea, but there's actually... It's taken very seriously, and there are reasons to believe why it might be true that life could have started on, you know, either some other planet in our solar system or some other solar system entirely and been delivered here. It's possible it's purposely, but in general, you know, scientists, we think that, it, you know, but be an asteroid or without purpose.
So Oumuamua is definitely aliens, right?
It's definitely alien in the sense that it is from another star system. But yeah, right. Whether or not it's actually aliens is, but that's what's so exciting about it, right? That's why everyone's like, oh my God. And the fact that it looks so different, just, you know, it looks like a giant needle, just, you know, just gets the science fiction screenwriters, you know, started.
Yeah. And so, I love that Newsweek had this headline, mysterious asteroid could be a galactic bus carrying life between solar systems. And then like 3 days later, they did update. Okay. Probably not. Or at least, the update, was that, that no scientists have been able to confirm any reason to believe that. In other words, the SETI folks were immediately on this going, you know, are there radio waves, something going on? So,
So
what was the buzz like when this thing first was noticed in October and over the last few months?
Well, you know, in general, you know, we don't go too straight to aliens, right?
I do.
Well, listen, I do too in my head, but not when I'm showing up at the department. Right?
Yeah, right.
I love
not
aliens.
Your professional context.
That's right. I just dropped all aliens. I mean, because look, everybody loves aliens. And what's interesting that's happening now is that, and we talked about this before, that we've made such profound advances in astrobiology that it really is time to stop snickering about it. I mean, you know, we're getting to the point where this has to be not UFOs, right? We can just leave the UFOs out of it. But the idea that, you know, either other civilizations out there or certainly just other life, we're very close in terms of actually having data over the next 20, 30 years that will at least address the question of life, meaning biospheres out there. So, you know, finding this rock that came from another star system really raises the question of panspermia in a very serious way.
Yeah, this takes us back to 2 years ago when we had the conversations about Tabby Star, Tabitha Boyajian, right, a postdoc at Yale, and her team discovered this star that had these weird dimmings of light. And the question was, is this the first time we're looking at maybe an alien megastructure surrounding a star, a so-called Dyson swarm or Dyson sphere?
Right.
And the answer from the data we have on that is probably not. On Oumuamua, it's probably not an alien probe spying on Earthlings or a bus carrying life between solar systems. So to you, I guess I want to ask this. You're right in that we're learning enough and we're seeing enough and our technology is getting better where we don't have to snicker right away at this stuff. But
right.
Does the fact that every time this has come up, people said, well, this could be and it's not, and then this could be and it's not. Does that, you know, make us feel like it's foolish for us to even be going in our minds to alien life?
No, I don't think so at all. I think it's completely reasonable, as long as we understand that the scientific search for this is going to take a long time. And like any other kind of science, like the science that developed, you know, the MRI that you use to figure out what was wrong with your shoulder, it is going to be long and slow and, you know, painful, right? Because that's what science is about. No, I mean, you know, just, you know, in terms of like painstaking. So that as long as people are willing to understand that, that unless, you know, aliens land on the White House lawn, what we're going to be learning about life in the universe is going to be through the usual methods of science. And that means it's going to be long and slow. And the larger the conclusion, you know, the more dramatic the conclusion, the more you need to back it up 50,000 ways from Wednesday, right? So I think it's perfectly fine to get excited about this. Look, this is the first time we have ever seen an asteroid, you know, a rock, a piece of another solar system, another star system passed through our own. I mean, that's profound. Like whether or not there's life on it, you know, I mean, you know, intelligent life, that's really going pretty far, but you know, there could be microbes on that. We're just not going to know because we couldn't visit it. But you know, 150 years from now, we might be in a position to actually visit the next one that goes passing through our solar system. So, you know, jumping to that remarkable conclusion is really part of the excitement of doing astronomy.
What's the deal with the shape of this thing, by the way?
Yeah, you tell me, what's the deal with the shape of that thing? I mean, that looks, you know, unlike any solar system object we've ever seen before. Now, probably it's due to, you know, whatever cataclysm blew it out of its star system. So, you know, what I mean is a planetary system, a set of planets, asteroids, comets around another star. We know stuff is constantly being tossed out of solar systems, right? The fact that our solar system is relatively clear of asteroids now, relatively, is because Jupiter and Saturn early on in the solar system gravitationally tossed out all of the debris that was left over from building Earth and Mars, etc. So, you know, it's we've expected that there was going to be material out there. But that shape, I think, is indicative of some particular violence in terms of, you know, collision between two objects that left that sort of shard-like shape. Either that or it's a missile from another, you know.
It's totally a missile. So panspermia is the idea that Earth is not where life started, or at least life here on Earth is not... did not start here and was brought here in some form. And then the other idea, the story of life on Earth is usually, as you write in NPR's 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog, known as, help me out with this, abiogenesis? How do you pronounce it?
Abiogenesis. Close enough.
I think I misspelled it. Abiogenesis. And that's the idea of life emerging from non-life through sort of... here, right? Through kind of replication, trial and error, and all that stuff?
Yeah, chemical evolution. You know, abiogenesis is the idea that on Earth, we had, you know, initially the planet was lifeless. And then, you know, you give it, you know, you have literally billions of years. Actually, what you have is about a half billion years between them, where there's no life and we have the first evidence of life on the planet. And, you know, chemistry was happening. There's all kinds of remarkable chemistry. And the thing we know since 1950, people have done experiments, that was the first one that was done, where we know that if you take the basic elements that were on the Earth then and add a little bit of energy, like electricity, that you can actually very rapidly form all of the amino acids you need for life, you know, which are the kind of the building blocks of proteins. So this was something called the Miller-Urey experiment, which was done in 1953, and it was groundbreaking because it showed that basically, you know, you start off with a warm pool of water, add some lightning, and boom, everything you need for proteins are there. So then the next question is, you know, you've got this pool of water or whatever. Now we've gotten more sophisticated about our ideas. And you've got these chemicals bouncing together, and they're combining, and they're breaking apart, and they're combining, and they're breaking apart, and, you know, et cetera, over and over again. And as soon as you get one that self-replicates, that has the machinery for building copies of itself, then that one wins, right? That one's going to beat out, because it's a self-replicator, it's going to beat out all of the other chemical reactions. And very soon, then, this pool is full of those self-replicators. So, you know, and then you get, you know, evolution takes its steps one further, and you get, you know, eventually, a membrane around it, the first cell, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the idea of abiogenesis.
It has much more reason, or at least, I mean, in terms of the world of evidence, I would think that it's got a lot more going for it than panspermia, right?
Well, and it's the problem. Here's the problem with panspermia. Panspermia just kicks the can down the road, right? And as I said in the blog, you know, that road is, you know, 20 light years or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it just says, look, it's got to happen somewhere. You know, I mean, you know, being scientists, if you're a scientist, you're not going to look for a miracle or a supernatural entity to do, you know, to do this. So it just means that somewhere else this happened. So, you know, somewhere or other, abiogenesis had to have happened. So what that means is, you know, either it happened on Earth or it happened somewhere else. If it happened somewhere else, then you're saying panspermia. But the, you know, panspermia, so you can say like, oh, who cares about panspermia? Because, you know, we still have to answer the question of abiogenesis anyway. And that's true. But what panspermia does is it shows something else. It opens another kind of window into thinking about this, which is that, for example, Mars early on may have been a better place to form life than Earth. There's reasons to argue that Mars was a better home for the first place for life to start. And we know that the planets are swapping spit. You know, the every time there's a large asteroid impact, that's the way I like to think of it. You know, they you know, pieces of Mars are blown into space, and then they'll circle around in the solar system, and then eventually they'll fall down Earth's gravity well. So there's we've found pieces of Mars on Earth, and there are surely pieces of Earth on Mars and Venus and et cetera the whole way around. So, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who's, you know, works very deeply in the whole question of Mars and life. And he said, you know, if we found life on Mars, he's not going to be surprised by that. But what he wants to know is whether it's our life, you know, that Mars, in some sense, that Mars, the life on Mars, was a version of our own, meaning that they came from a single ancestor. He, you know, what's really interesting to him would be as if the life you found on Mars had a completely, you know, didn't use DNA, for example. Like, that would be significant.
Yeah, I want to come back in a moment to this piece written by Jacob Hock-Misra for the Blue Marble Space Institute of Science in Seattle, The Transformative Value of Liberating Mars. And I want to talk more about that in a moment. But before we get there, a couple of other points for our listeners. Our guest this hour is Adam Frank, professor of astrophysics at the University of Rochester and co-founder of NPR's 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog. And in the coming year, we're going to have a chance to talk to Adam about his new book, which is going to be out when, by the way?
June 2018.
June of 2018, and that's going to meet the deadline, right? I mean, is it all put to bed? Is it with the publisher?
It's done. I've got the galleys. I've got the first look at it.
That's a beautiful thing
to see something you worked on that hard.
Yeah. So before we peel it back, you know, too deeply, which we're going to do in the months to come, why don't you tell our listeners very briefly what it's about?
The title is Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds and the Fate of the Earth. And it's basically about aliens and climate change, as I like to say. It's basically trying to completely recast our understanding of what's happening to us now on Earth with climate change, et cetera, by you know, building out the understanding that this is not probably the first time it's happened in the universe, that there have been other civilizations over the course of cosmic space and time. And I bring, you know, I talk about the arguments for that. And that, you know, once you understand the laws of planets as the way we do now and the laws of climate, that any civilization most likely will trigger climate change. And so the big question is, who makes it through? What do you need to make it through this bottleneck? And, you know, by looking at our problem that way, I think it completely changes our understanding of what's happening in this moment, this climate changed moment that we live in.
Listeners, if you want to call the program as we talk about these and related subjects, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I want to call it back to a program we had just a couple of weeks ago as we talked about this piece in The Atlantic about China's efforts to make first contact. And I thought The Atlantic did a wonderful job of at least telling the story of what China is trying to do with the world's biggest radio dish that's now operational in the remote Chinese mountains. Their idea being, you know, if they can find radio signals, if there are signals to be found, China will find them first. And then what do we do with that? Do we make contact in some way? And, you know, Adam, on the program, we talked about the dark forest theory of the universe, which is that there are lots of technological civilizations and they are hiding because they know that if they poke their head up and they're visible, another technological civilization could wipe them out. And I thought that was pretty compelling, but I had my mind changed on that program, I'm happy to say, by our guests of that hour. How do you feel about the idea of the dark forest theory?
I'm a little inclined towards it. You know, we have this sort of idea that, like, oh, you know, species that are more advanced than us are somehow going to be benevolent, and they're going to wear long white robes, and, you know, they're going to float at 3 inches off the ground. And I don't know why that's true. I think caution, you know, is a better idea. I just kind of feel like, I don't take it, because of my feeling, in general, I'm not an optimist about the nearby galaxy being populated with, you know, species. I just think it may be hard enough to make that. I think there's certainly been other civilizations, but the idea that, like, we're in the middle of this, you know, vast galactic civilization, I'm a little bit skeptical of. But if it was true, I think caution is a better, is a better idea than sort of, standing out and announcing to everybody, especially when we're so young as a species. I think we should be a little bit cautious.
Well, here's why I asked that. I want to go to this paper about the idea of liberating Mars, and we're going to get into some stuff that, you know, part of the conversation about astrobiology is working in, you know, the plot details of the human experience that might be hard to imagine right now. For example, not to give a Star Wars spoiler away, because we don't do spoilers here. By the way, are you a Star Wars fan, Adam Frank?
I am a Star Wars fan, and I saw the movie, so I won't do any spoilers either. Yeah, but I'm not as big a fan. I'm more of a Star Trek fan, or The Expanse. My favorite show right now is The Expanse.
Okay. So. Did you like the new movie?
I did like the new movie. I surprisingly liked the new movie. One of the reasons I'm not a huge Star Wars fan, I mean, the first movie in 1977 changed my life. I mean, I'm not kidding. I saw it 15 times when it came out. Those middle three, whatever you want, however the numbering goes, were just so, I thought they were so dumb. They lost me with that, you know? So I'm climbing back on the boat.
Well, the reason I bring that up is just because some people have this outrage that one of the characters in the film, and this is not a big spoiler, it's just a thing where that character is able to somehow breathe in the expanse of space. You know,
right. My son and I got into an argument about that yesterday.
Aha! and then some of the criticism is, look, you're watching a fictional trilogy about space wizards and you're upset about a plot detail. You know,
exactly.
So I think there's something to that. But do you want to weigh in? Was that a dumb part of the plot? Was that okay with you?
No, because, again, they're absolutely right. Space wizards, right? I mean, Star Wars has never made any attempt to be scientifically, even tiny a bit scientifically accurate, right? There's that famous thing in the first movie about, you know, where Han Solo talks about making the Kessler run in 88, you know, light years or whatever. You know, it got the basic idea of distance and time wrong. And since then, who cares? It's Star Wars. Now, Star Trek or, you know, things like The Expanse, where they, you know, they are trying to build a scientifically consistent universe and live in it. Yeah, those ones you expect a little bit more out of. But in Star Wars, it's fine. You know?
Well, eventually, we will be, eventually, the human species, if we hang around long enough,
right,
and maybe sooner than later, thinking about things that seem like science fiction right now. And this piece that Jacob Hock-Mizra wrote for the Blue Marble Space Institute of Science in Seattle, I thought it was fascinating. Adam sent it along before the program. It's about the transformative value of liberating Mars. And let me read the abstract, because, like, the second you start thinking about this, you're like, wait, this is about so many different things at once. He writes,
yeah,
humanity has the knowledge to solve its problems, but lacks the moral insight to implement these ideas on a global scale. New moral insight can be obtained through transformative experiences that allow us to examine and refine our underlying preferences, and the eventual landing of humans on Mars will be of tremendous transformative value. So, and then he says, before such an event, I propose that we liberate Mars from any controlling interests of Earth and allow Martian settlements to develop into a second independent instance of human civilization. Adam, why did you set this to me for a reason? Because you obviously thought it was fascinating, too. What do you make of that?
Yeah. Well, okay, the first thing I want listeners to understand, though, right, when we talk about, you know, moving out into the solar system, not the stars right now, because the stars are a long way away, but the solar system, I want, you know, people think, like, oh my God, that's so crazy, it's science fiction. I want people to stop for a moment and imagine 150 years ago, right? 150 years ago is like 1870, right? Now, that was after the Civil War. There was already, there's already telegraphs. There were trains, right? 150 years ago, you can imagine 150 years. I just went to see the play at Geneva about, Rochester, right after the Civil War, Susan B. Anthony,
yep,
and Frederickson.
You know, so Frederick Douglass.
Frederick Douglass, sorry. So it's not that hard to imagine 150 years ago, right? It's a stretch. People were wearing funny clothes. But basically, you know, that was your great, 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 great-grandfather, not even that far. Now, you know, I have to do the numbers. But, you know, so 150 years ago is not that far, really, to imagine. 150 years from now, with, you know, if things go in a certain direction, we could easily have millions of people living in various places in the soul, tens of millions, or maybe even a billion by that time. 150 years is a long enough time because we're poised for this right now. We are poised to begin the settlement of the solar system right now. Now, whether it'll work or not, that's for the future to decide. But I mean, we're ready to do this right now. And that's something I hope we'll talk a little bit about. So I don't want people to sort of think this is some kind of crazy science fiction, you know, that is so far. Their grandkids could easily be, you know, or their great grandkids could easily be taking trips to Mars, you know, for vacation, or that's where their job is. So, you know, that's the first thing I want people to sort of hold, to really open up, you know, their perspective to see that it's, you know, this is not that far away potentially. Okay, so with that, you know, let me just say, I think the awesome thing about his idea is that what he's really saying is that if you get settlements on Mars, the way to make this work, the way this to be transformative for humanity, is that when you go to Mars, you renounce all your human, you know, all your Earth citizenship. You are no longer a citizen of the United States or China or whatever. Once you go to Mars, you're a Martian. And any companies that want to go, you know, exploit Martian resources, they have to become Martian companies. They cannot be Earth companies. So he's saying, like, literally, you have to cut your ties and allow Mars to develop as a true independent line of civilization, you know, separate from what's happened on Earth.
I find that very interesting, but how do you think humans would do at allowing sort of an organic creation of a Martian state that is populated by no longer Earthlings, you know, forms of government, all of those factors?
Well, I think one of the things, I mean, there's a certain way in which you can either do it purposely or it's going to happen probably anyway, right? So let's just, before we go too far down that road, let's just think about what we mean by this. No matter what, once you start settling space, right? Once you start building a settlement on Mars, you start, you know, doing things on asteroids. You know, there's this, you know, amazing idea, I don't know if it's possible, of like hollowing out asteroids and spinning them up and, you know, letting people live on the inside, or you just have, you know, very large space habitats. Once you start doing that, the distances involved are large enough that those, you know, once they become semi-self-sustaining, it's going to be very hard to govern them from Earth because they're far enough away. Look what happened with the American colonies. Right.
I mean,
you
right.
know, it's so, you know, the idea that people have always thought about is that each one of these settlements will be an experiment in human civilization, that they, you know, will be able, they're going to be far enough away that they're going to be able to try and form under new principles, you know, some may be dark, some may be good, some, you know, I mean, that's sort of the idea, but there'll be experiments in being human. And so what Jacob is suggesting in that paper is that Mars, which is probably the best target for a really large scale human presence, that we do this purposely, right? Rather than sort of have the Martians eventually revolt against their, you know, their earthly masters, which is part of every science fiction story ever about the colonization of Mars, you know, to do it purposely, to free Mars, you know, now before it settles and before we have to go through this process where they're like, you know, rebelling against Earth.
Yeah, and he says, you know, even, you know, land use on Mars is determined exclusively by the citizens of Mars. That Earthlings go to Mars and they cannot accumulate wealth for use on Earth. So that would become sort of a mad rush to go. Well, not a mad rush. I don't think a bunch of wagon trains are headed to Mars tomorrow.
Right, that's the problem, yeah.
But you say, and by the way, we're going to get to the phones in a second. Bruce and Arondaquit will take your call. I've got some emails as well. But let me just stay with this and kind of see it through here, because it sounds to me like what Jacob is proposing is that, you know, whoever gets there gets the first way of kind of governing and setting up life on Mars. It's not controlled by Vladimir Putin or Donald Trump or President Pence or whoever. It's set up there and controlled there. And you say that we're not that far away from being actually ready to settle parts of the solar system. So if that's a surprise to people, explain a little bit more.
Well, okay, so, you know, we have this idea that, you know, in order to go to space, you need a giant space program from a nation, and there's astronauts and they're heroes and the whole bit that we've had since, you know, the beginning of the space race. But what people don't realize is that over the last 10 years, a movement has grown, which is sometimes it goes by different names, but one of the names is New Space, New Space. And what it is commercial enterprises that, you know, there's a number of companies out there that have huge capital investment. That are, you know, wanting to take the first steps of the commercial use of space. And I'm of the belief, I mean, I think you need both, but I'm of the belief that unless there's some living to be made out there, it's never going to happen. And so what's amazing is, you know, you've got Elon Musk, you've got Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos' company, you've got Virgin Galactic, you've got a number of companies that are interested in doing space mining. So, you know, and all these companies are, you know, I mean, SpaceX is routinely launching stuff into, you know, has commercial contracts. And, you know, of course, Elon Musk's explicit goal is to get people on Mars, as to have, because, you know, he thinks we need a second, just a, you know, sort of a second base, so to speak, that humanity can't just rely on Earth. So it's happening already. You know, now whether it's successful or not, that's what's for the future to decide. But already there is a huge amount of commercial investment in the use of space to make money.
My guest is Adam Frank, who is the co-founder of NPR's 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog, a professor of astrophysics at the University of Rochester, the author of numerous books, including a forthcoming book that, among other things, is going to examine climate change's role in civilizations across the galaxies, not just us, and ways that we can sort of commune with everybody else who's had to go through this, because we're being tested right now. We're going to get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back to Bruce, Tim. We've got some emails. Yes, Robert. Robert wants to set us straight on Star Wars science. We're going to do that, too. Adam Frank is our guest for the hour right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we are going to go to Kai Rizdahl and the Marketplace team for they're going to take a look at what's going on with the tax policy and the new tax bill. You've got questions. You want answers on how it's structured, who benefits, where those benefits flow, and more. Kai Rizdahl and the team, next hour, breaking it all down. Timely, relevant, vital. That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's go to the phones. Bruce in Irondequoit first. Go ahead, Bruce.
I love that he loves The Expanse, and the reason I like it, it cuts the middle between that Star Trekian, everybody learn to get along together, and now we're going out and selling that to the universe, and the big Star, you know, Star Wars, big evil and big good. I mean, they kept everything of who we are, the bitterness, the rivalries. Mars went out and got colonized and then had a fight for its freedom. That's ingrained in who we are. That's what we are, and that's what I love about The Expanse.
Thank you, Bruce. Adam?
Bruce, I couldn't agree more. People should watch The Expanse. It is the best science fiction show in 10 years. And they really work. What's amazing is they really work to get the science right of what a life in a colonized or a settled solar system would be like. So, you know, when your engines are on your spaceship, there's gravity because you're accelerating forward. So you're pushed down onto the floor. When the rockets turn off, you're weightless. I mean, there's just so many ways in which, the science is done correct, but the human, as you said, it's about sort of this sort of cold war in space. And there was something in the, I think it was The Economist that basically said the best program about politics right now is about the future, is about The Expanse. So they do a beautiful job of sort of this rivalry between Earth, Mars, and then the asteroid belt, the people who live in the asteroid belt, who are basically an oppressed class. It's brilliant, and it's got aliens in it too.
Aliens. So before I go to Tim in Rochester, who's going to bring us back to the questions between kind of a relationship between aliens and climate change, Tim, hang there for one more second. I just want to say a couple of things and read one quick email. You know, Adam is talking about on this program and on many programs we've talked about aliens, climate change, related issues. I think astrobiology is a field that I find so fascinating. And as we look back at the end of a calendar year, we don't do a whole lot of calendar journalism. We do some. We do some look backs or kind of year in reviews, and some that I think are valuable. It's always fun to think back to our favorite guests. And Adam is always at the top of the list. He's got a colleague named David Grinspoon. We loved having David on earlier this year. You should check out his book. You know, people like Jacob Hock-Misra who are asking us to think about what life would be like if you really wanted to liberate Mars. I think this stuff actually matters. I mean, I know that the day-to-day details of governing matter very much. And next hour, we're letting the Marketplace team dive into tax policy. But we're also thinking about ethics and morality at a larger scale here. And if we don't think on large scales, I fear for our sort of collective future. And I just think the work that people like Adam are doing is so important. So now on that note, Robert wants to have a very serious question. He says, Adam, I got to set y'all straight. The Kessel Run is a smuggler's route in Star Wars using a, using a series of black holes to travel vast distances. The maximum safe distance was 12 parsecs, but the Millennium Falcon did it in less. Hence, while confusing, it is not scientifically inaccurate.
I bow to the the superior knowledge. Thank you very much for.
I love
that's
it.
Awesome.
Thank you, Robert. I'm not positive that all of Star Wars is perfectly scientifically accurate, but maybe that
at
part.
At least that part. Now
that
we
part,
know
that part. Here's Tim in Rochester. Go ahead, Tim.
Good. Hi. Yeah. So thanks. This is great, Adam. It's great to hear you on again, and I'm deeply fascinated by the subject. So I'm a climate activist that comes at it from a spiritual point of view, and I'm also interested in cosmology. So my question is this: if you could expand a bit more on either this article in The Atlantic or your own thinking in the book about the relationship between morality and aliens and climate change, I think it's a fundamental, profoundly critical issue and question of consciousness, and I'm just really curious to hear more of what your thinking is or what the author of this article has to say about it.
Thank you, Tim. Go ahead, Adam.
Well, I think, you know, when it comes to what climate change does for us is, or what it's pushed us to, is the recognition in some sense that we're the aliens, right? We think about like alien civilizations and they're, you know, they travel through space and they have, you know, they have enormous, capacities. But we have already reached that. Climate change, you know, there's a way in which we look at climate change, which we should be saying like, wow, we're pretty awesome. We changed the climate of an entire planet, right? I mean, what it shows is, we're at the edge of maturity. We are, as I like to say in the book, cosmic teenagers. And we've reached the point where we become a planetary force. Now, the next step in that question, this is where the next step in dealing with that is a question of values, which means it's a question of morality, and it's a question of ethics, which is, what do we do with that power, right? As, you know, as Spider-Man found out, with great power comes great responsibility. And here the responsibility is not only to ourselves, but to the rest of life on the planet. Because in order to have a sustainable long-term version of our civilization, we're going to have to come into some kind of collective relationship with the rest of the biosphere on which we depend. Because if we don't, the biosphere will just move on without us. You know, it's not about saving the Earth. The Earth's going to be just fine. It's about having a cooperative relationship between civilization and the Earth. So in that way, it speaks to something that is one of the deepest questions that human beings can ask, which is, what are we and where are we and what is our responsibility to both ourselves and the world around us? And climate change shows us that we're about to become adults. If we make it, we will become adults. If we don't make it, then we'll be another failed experiment in the universe. And I think there's been lots of experiments in civilization building.
Yeah, really wonderful, wonderful articulation of the whole notion of the emergence of our consciousness as a species and right. and the whole, you know, teenage adult thing, a sense of responsibility. You know, I would say that the effects of the transition into adulthood as a species are not only for the Earth and all life on the Earth, but indeed for other parts of the galaxy and other parts of the universe that we are part of and in relationship with matter and life and form around the universe. And so there's the prospect that there's a real concern and a real interest, however conscious, on the parts of other aspects of the universe for what we are doing and for our emergence, for our maturation. You know, I think the analogy of adolescence to adulthood is spot on. And the implications are beyond the Earth itself, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of joining a more conscious universal community. But, you know, the whole piece on the fundamental kind of axiomatic philosophical kind of thing has to be at some point a worldview in terms of you're talking about identity. Who are we as a species? And to me, it has to come from some sense of connection, of interrelatedness, that from Native American, from indigenous wisdom through the ages, that we are connected with all that is, with the earth, with each other, within ourselves, and with the cosmos. So to me, unless we, and until we direct our thought energy towards a sense of connection, of relationship, of universal community, you know, we're still working at it. We're still you know, in the process of
well, we're very much at the beginning. I mean, we haven't. Yeah, yeah. It really is very much at the first step. And I, you know, there's the parts of that of what you're saying I really agree with is the idea of stories that we need. You know, I talk about this in the book about the importance of myth, right? And so, you know, my first book on science religion, I did a lot of time looking at Joseph Campbell and other scholars of myth. And, you know, the problem with climate change and the reason why we're stuck in this ridiculous thing with denialism is because we have a lot of science that absolutely shows that climate change is happening, but we don't have a story that makes sense of it. You know, human beings, the Industrial Revolution didn't begin when the first factory was built. We didn't see ourselves as industrial until, like, there were millions of people living and, you know, had moved to cities and were, you know, spending their lives in factories and you know, the technologies had swept across the ways of life. Then we could start telling stories about ourselves as a species that had conquered the earth with, you know, rubber and steel and oil. And so this, you know, the climate change, we're just entering the climate change world. You know, you think about those pictures of, you know, Houston, the highway that was basically a river, right? We're just beginning to see those pictures. So this narrative, this story about who we are, what we are, what's our relationship to life and the planet, I think we're just beginning to sort of formulate. So, you know, myth and story, and those are always, they're not just science, they're about values, they're about what we hold sacred, what we believe is valuable. And those, that's the next step for us in making sense of climate change. And that has to be an astrobiological story. You know, that myth, you know, the myths, and by myth, I don't mean fake story or false story. What I mean is grand narrative. That myth is going to be a scientific myth, you know, it's going to have science in it, and it's going to connect us to, you know, the big history, as they call it, which is the history of the universe itself.
Now, I just want to say, I think Adam's book is going to maybe change the way some people communicate about climate change on this planet, because I had a chance to see Adam speak at a recent event, and you know, I don't want to give away too many themes, and I want to wait to read the book, and we will explore it again when the book is out next year with Adam Frank. But Adam, when you just mentioned in your response to Tim's phone call that, you know, the planet doesn't need saving, and one of the things that I think is so effective is the way that you communicate in a way that will appeal to just about anybody, or at least I think it can, but it's also asks us to sort of reevaluate how we communicate. So when we say we want to save the planet, you kind of riffed and said the planet's gone through a lot of moods and ideas about things, and you know, we're just sort of a current mood, and if it needs to move on to other things, it will do that without us, but it will, right, it will do other things without us. We don't need to save it.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, the thing that's interesting about that idea is that one of the things we've learned in the last 50 years of all of our space exploration, right, we've sent probes to every solar system object, kind of solar system object, including all, you know, all of the planets. And what we see, we've come to understand planets, and planets are powerful. You know, the idea that, like, you know, that we need to save the Earth. No, we need, as I like to say, if you're, I hope this isn't, you know, isn't violating the FCC, right? But we have to not piss the planet off. You know, I mean, that's really what we have to do, because the planet is still far more powerful than we are, even though we have become a power in itself. What we've done, we've become a power enough to tip the Earth to have it move in a different direction. And, you know, the question is whether or not it'll just roll off into some state that's very difficult for us and could lead to a collapse of this kind of civilization. So, yeah, really fundamentally, that view misunderstands what planets are.
Adam Frank, my guest, astrophysicist and an author, the co-founder of NPR's 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog. Dan writes to the program and says, on the subject of Earth to Mars, interesting hypothetical about Martian society. I can't help but think of the Twilight Zone episode, How to Serve Man. To go from Earth to Mars, regardless of all practical concerns, would be quite the leap of faith, wouldn't it? That's from Dan. Adam?
Well, you know, I think the building of a Martian settlement will be, you know, a slow going, right? I mean, there's huge technological challenges. I mean, let's not be, Pollyanna about this. Settling the solar system will require, you know, huge technological advances, a lot of bravery, and it'll take time. But on the other hand, you know, human beings, the one thing we are definitely capable of is solving problems, solving technological problems. So, the creation of a Martian settlement will, you know, I would imagine a real settlement, a self-sustaining settlement, you know, would be on the order of, you know, 20, 30, 40 years. So I think it would take some time. And the evolution that happens there is going to determine a lot of sort of, you know, while it's being built and what the ties that are established among the Martians will go a long way towards telling us which direction it's going to go. But I would really recommend people, there's a lot of good reading about this. The Expanse is one series, even though it's, you know, about other things, but its depiction of the Martian settlement is, or Martian civilization is great. There's also Kim Stanley Robinson's, this is the most important book on this, the Red Mars, Blue Mars, Green Mars series. And I highly recommend that one, because that one, it was written in the, I think, the late 80s, early 90s. And that set the stage for people really renewed thinking about the solar system as the future of humanity.
Hmm. Well, Dan follows up on that note and says, here on this planet, given that so much power is wielded on our planet by people who caused and continue to drive climate change, who does your guest think might wind up being the leaders of our cosmic maturation, wherein we come to live in harmony with our environment?
Yeah, that's a good question. The young people, a lot of times I hear people being very, you know, dissing millennials, you know, like, oh, millennials, worst generation ever. I don't find that at all, because, you know, I teach them, right? I just had the most amazing class. I had 16 young students in one of my classes, and, you know, they were great. They were funny, and they were determined, and they're energetic, and they're, you know, they're ready to go out there and solve those problems. So in a lot of ways, I think, you know, we need to get out of their way, because A, it's going to be their future, but also, you know, they're bringing a lot to the table in terms of, you know, a different perspective and new ideas. You know, you look at the polls on climate change, the denial is not with the millennials. You know, the millennials overwhelmingly accept science, value science, and understand that the science behind climate change is, you know, is a closed and shut case now. So I think that those are the ones you have to look to the young to be. They're the ones that are going to lead this.
You can find some of Adam's work on NPR's Cosmos and Culture blog, 13.7. And recently, one of Adam's pieces took a look at science's journey from data to truth. And if you don't mind, I'd just like to read a little from that piece, and you can kind of tell us a little bit more about why you wanted to kind of highlight these ideas here. So you write, in the era of fake news, or in an era, it feels like the era of fake. Hopefully the only era. This is the only era. In an era of fake news and alternative facts, we now face a massive disconnect between what science thinks it understands about the world, i.e. global warming, and what some people want to believe is true. But how does science come to know anything about anything? After all, what is science but a collection of people who call themselves scientists? So isn't it as flawed as everything else that people create? Well, last week I had the chance to watch the human side of science in action. I was in Hong Kong at a meeting focused on how stars die. It's an amazing act of hubris to think that we humans, bound to lives that barely last a century, have anything to say about stars and their billion-year lifespans. But there we were, about 60 women and men from every part of the world, arguing over data gathered by stunningly complex machines that watch the skies for us. In those numbers, we thought we could read something about the last gasps of stars, like the sun, end quote. Very powerful three paragraphs for me that can start to at least shut down the people who are like, well, what does science actually know? But why did you want to write that piece right now?
Well, because this has been a bad year for science. This has been a really bad year for American science. One thing I want to note is I was in Hong Kong for this conference, and I saw that, you know, the things that are happening here when it comes to science are not happening other places. You know, we are poised to lose the race. You know, we're in a very good position right now to lose the race. As you pointed out, China just has built the largest telescope, you know, in the world, the radio telescope in the world. You know, the other countries are pouring money into science. And if, you know, if you're a young person who's interested in science, where are you going to go? Right. You know, people want to come to America because of the freedom and the, you know, the tradition, scientific traditions we have. But this has been, you know, the first year of an erosion of those, you know, pretty serious, you know, scary erosion of those fundamental values. And, you know, I spend a lot of time because of my writing dealing with people who are climate change deniers. And I'm stunned by the things they say, you know, the things that are just, I hate to use this word, but the willful ignorance of people who use science all the time for their own benefit. And in this one area, because it's been politicized, will say these things that are just mind-numbingly, you know, closed-minded to the science, to the basic principles of science. So, you know, it's always really important for me to people understand how science works. You know, it is a human process that somehow transcends us, you know, allows us to go beyond our imperfections and our biases and our prejudices. And when you watch it really at work, when you really watch people, like I was at this conference, arguing with each other over points of science and see how a whole community can sort of, how the evidence can push a whole community in one direction. Like, okay, we thought we knew this, but now we've got all this data, and, you know, we're going to have to give up some of those ideas. And there's still some people like, no, I'm holding on. But eventually the community's like, no, look, we got a hold of the data. And you'll watch the whole community sort of shift over and, you know, and start to move in a new direction. And it's just so vital that people understand how this thing that people do allows us to find public truth. And by public truth, I mean truths that we can, you know, if everybody goes through the method, everybody will get the same answer.
So last couple questions before we lose the hour with astrophysicist Adam Frank. You say it's been a bad year for American science in 2017. What's funding been like, especially on issues that you have been following like climate?
Well, so far, you know, it's a little early to see what's going to happen exactly with the funding. So I think we have to wait for that. I haven't really seen fundamental changes in the funding. I mean, we have certainly seen what with NASA and the climate satellites. That has been stunning. That there have been, you know, there are satellites which are not just for climate, but for agriculture. You know, they're used for all different things that help American, American society. That there's been a bunch of cuts or proposed cuts to some of these NASA climate programs, so quote unquote climate programs, they're Earth observing programs. So that was already pretty bad. But where exactly the funding is going to go for next year, it's still a little too early to tell.
And let me then close with this. And as you say, you get frustrated by people who use science to benefit themselves every day in their lives, but then they want to pick and choose what they are willing to believe when science brings it to them, such as climate change. And your book deals with some of this and more. How do you make sure it's not just preaching to the choir in the future on this issue?
Well, again, you know, when it comes to, I think there are certain people for whom, because of the tribalism that we sort of have now, that there's some people, there's just, no matter what you do, they're not interested. You know what I mean? They're not interested in the science or the fact that science is something to say. And I don't know really what to do for people like that. But I think the vast majority of people fundamentally are interested. They're using science or, you know, and I think for them, it's to break out of this tribalism. And that's what I'm trying to do is that, you know, one of the things I think people should understand is that climate change shows how awesome human beings are on some level, right? It shows how powerful we've become. This is not a story of, oh, human beings are terrible, we're greedy, we're, you know, it shows the capacities that we could have, you know? And so, but we now have to, if we don't recognize that what we've done and we don't correct it, you know, if we allow people who have vested interests in the old ways, then, you know, fundamentally, it's a story about us being losers. We're going to end up being losers in this sort of cosmic experiment. So I think it's again changing the narrative to break out of that fundamental tribalism that we're locked into.
That's interesting. That will be interesting to see if it works, because our politics, our tribalism, has been sort of reduced in recent years to just, you know, everyone wanting to be winners on the winning team, on the winning political
team,
be perceived as winners, and letting people know we are in danger of becoming societal losers is
right. Cosmic losers.
Who knows? Who knows if that works? Thanks for taking the time, and I always enjoy the conversation. For our listeners,
this is
great fun. This is
a
great early Christmas gift to our listeners when Adam Frank came on the program. I will talk to you in 2018, and there's much more to talk about. We'll talk about your book and much more. Happy holidays, happy new year, and talk to you then, Adam.
Thank you, Evan, and happy holidays to everybody.
Adam Frank, our guest, co-founder of NPR's 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog and a professor of astrophysics at the University of Rochester. You will be hearing from him on his book that comes out next year. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Ooh, I like that. There's the reverb. Rob's the man who makes me sound cosmic myself there. Though, that's a misnomer. If I were to jump out in space and try to talk like this, it wouldn't actually reverb. I would just die. Megan Mack is the producer, and I'm Evan Dawson. Coming up next hour, tax policy. It's a great way to end the week with a lot of knowledge coming from Kai Rizdahl and the team. We are back with you next week. Enjoy the holiday. Merry Christmas to everyone from the Connection staff, and we'll talk to you then.